Winston Churchill I knew very well. I mean, as insofar as a boy of 16 can know a very, very distinguished old man of 75, you know, whatever age difference was.
Yeah.
But we saw actually quite a lot of him.
That was John Julius Norwich reminiscing about his earlier life.
The West is no longer perhaps quite sure what it stands for, and it seems to me that there is a story which can be told and should be told.
And that was Larry Seedentop discussing the history of Western liberalism. Hello, and welcome to the History Extra podcast. My name is Rob Attar, and I'm the editor of BBC History Magazine, which is the UK's best-selling history magazine. You can find us in all good newsagents, or you can take out a subscription from anywhere in the world. See historyextra.com/subscribe-today for subscription deals. Plus, we have digital editions for the iPad, the Kindle Fire, Google Play, and Zinio. For details of all of these, please head to historyextra.com/digital. And I should add that we've also recently launched on Kobo. You'll find us under the e-magazine section on Kobo.com. A silent film star, renowned intellectual, host and celebrity, and the wife of the Secretary of State for War, Lady Diana Cooper lived a fascinating life, encountering many of the leading figures of her age. She also wrote an extensive series of letters to her son, the historian John Julius Norwich, detailing her experiences. Following the publication of a set of these letters, covering the years 1939 to 1952, our reviews editor Matt Elton met up with John Julius to explore what they reveal about a largely vanished world.
Well, I had all these letters from my mother, which she had been very, very careful and never stopped reminding me to keep my letters, you know. So, I mean, as a child in the war, it's not terribly easy to do that. And I have to say that one or two little files went astray.
Okay, yes.
But I think I probably got about 90%, which this is only a tiny percentage.
Wow.
Because, I mean, there's much, much more. We had to weed through and choose and select, you know.
So how many letters are we talking in total?
Well, I'm sorry, I have no idea.
A lot.
But, I mean, I think here there must be probably 300.
Wow. So it is a lot.
And there are many, many, many more. In the archive, we've actually put all the rest now in the archives of Churchill College.
Oh, cool.
Cambridge.
Okay.
Where they've got all my father's as well. So if anybody wants to go there and look them up, there they all are.
Oh, brilliant. Fantastic. And for people that might not know, could you talk through your mother and your father and their roles before, I suppose, the war?
Certainly. Well, my mother, as she said, had always been a celebrity. In those days, there were no such things as sort of film stars and things. She was... The point about her really was that she was very, very beautiful. She was a knockout, and she had a character to match. So she always got a lot of publicity in the social columns and that sort of thing. She was generally thought to be the youngest daughter of the Duke of Rutland. In fact, she wasn't. She was the daughter of a lovely, much more interesting figure called Harry Cust, who had a long affair with my grandmother, and whom it is said might be the grandfather of Mrs. Thatcher.
Really?
So maybe I'm Mrs. Thatcher's first cousin.
Okay.
I've never dared ask the family for a DNA, but it was, no. It could be.
Mm.
Anyway, she grew up. She was born in 1892. So she grew up really, I mean, when the war broke out, 1814, she was what? 1914, I mean, she was what, 22? And all the young men went off to war, and very, very nearly all the young men got killed. She fell in love with my father, whom her parents thought most unsuitable. His father had started life as a doctor in Norwich, and he had no money at all, and no birth or breeding or whatever it was called in those days. But she loved him. And really good luck that he survived. He really only survived because in 1912 he had joined the Foreign Service. And that meant that he was what was called a reserve profession. They needed him in London to run the Foreign Service, as it were. And so it was only in 1916, when Mr. Asquith was succeeded by Lloyd George. And by this time, there were practically no young officers left. They were all of them dead. Mm. My mother told me once that at the end of 1916, every man she had ever danced with was dead. I mean, God, it's a thing we can't begin to imagine what it must have been like.
No.
Everybody would be. And my father, in 1916 at last, was allowed to join up because he was feeling pretty bad about it, all his friends going off and him just staying in a nice warm, you know, having all the girls. But eventually he was allowed to go, and he went. But he didn't get to the front until, I think, January 1918. Okay. So he only had 10 months of it, during which he won himself a DSO, and I mean, he did extremely well. But, I mean, if he had been there for 4 years, I wouldn't be here talking to you now.
I know.
No doubt at all. He'd been killed like everybody else. Anyway, there it was. He was, by that time, just about the only one dead. My grandmother was still perfectly furious. I mean, she thought that the Prince of Wales was very nearly good enough for her beloved daughter. You know.
Yes.
But anyway, she had to bite on the bullet and accept this extremely unwelcome son-in-law, which he really was. And she was beastly to him, too. She was not a nice woman at all. Anyway, there it was. And then my mother, very soon after their marriage, they married in 1919. In 1922, I think, she became, to her enormous surprise and the considerable disapproval of most of her parents' generation, a film star.
Yes, yes.
And she became a film star. She made two films, in both of which she starred, silent, of course. One was in colour, rather surprisingly. I've seen it. I mean, it's a very primitive sort of colour, but it's in colour.
Mm.
All right. And one of them, in which he played Queen Elizabeth, it's called The Virgin Queen, has disappeared without trace. Mm. The other one, called The Glorious Adventure, is a marvellous bit of romantic kitsch set in the time of the Fire of London.
Okay.
It did actually rather well. And that was a great success. But what really made it successful was that it caught the imagination, or the eye, of the greatest international producer of the day, who was called Max Reinhardt.
So how old were you at the period when these letters in this book
I
start?
I was nine.
You were nine, okay.
And when they start, and I was about 20 when they finish. Hmm. And
so it covers a whole range of time.
So it covers quite a long time, including what was a very exciting time, particularly for my parents, which was the war.
Yes.
And I was evacuated to America and Canada in June 1940, being, 10 years old. And I was evacuated because my father was a cabinet minister who had resigned from Neville Chamberlain's government at the time of the Munich Agreement because he desperately disapproved of doing the deal with Hitler. He knew that Hitler was undoable with deals with, you know. And my mother had this idea. What you have to remember, which I think is very hard for all of us to realize today, in the summer of 1940, the question was not, is Hitler going to invade? It is, when is the invasion going to be?
Right.
I mean, is it next week or is it the week after? I mean, it was actually like that.
Yeah.
You know, and my mother had this sort of nightmare that I would be seized by the invading Germans and held as a sort of hostage for my father's good behavior. Because my father was on the blacklist. Mm. He was number three on the blacklist.
Wow, that's
after
incredible.
Winston Churchill and Anthony Eden. And she had this sort of horror that I'd be held and had my fingernails torn out or something. And anyway, so I was sent off to America. And she, of course, stayed. My father was Minister of Information, so she and he stayed in London all through the Blitz. And she wrote to me every day from the Blitz. And there's a lot of marvellous stuff, sort of Blitz
work. It's amazing, the letters. They're amazing.
I mean, they are extraordinary.
I know.
And so she wrote to me every night. And then after the Blitz was over in 1941, I was still in America, my father was sent to do a report on the defences in the Far East, which, as we now know, were practically non-existent. Mm.
There's some incredible characters in the book as well, some really famous people. Do you remember kind of meeting any of these famous people?
Oh, I met all of them. Winston Churchill I knew very well. I mean, insofar as a boy of 16 can know a very, very distinguished old man of 75, you know, whatever age difference was.
Yeah.
But we saw actually quite a lot of him. Not so much during the war, but after the war. In 1940, 7:48. Well, the end, no, 48. Because what happened was my father was, he was sent to Algiers in 1944 to be a person, to be the, Churchill's personal representative, General de Gaulle. And the Free French were in Algiers. That was their base. But by this time, everybody knew that we were winning the war, and it was only a question of months before Paris was liberated. And the deal was that when Paris was liberated, my father would go in as the first post-war ambassador, which he did. He went in. Paris was liberated, I think, on the 29th of August, and on about mid-September, my parents arrived. Mm. And that was pretty grim. I mean, I went there over for Christmas, and that was pretty grim too in the first thing, because it was the coldest winter Paris has had for 50 years, and nobody had any fuel or heating. So this embassy life started, and when he didn't retire, it wasn't his drive, when he was switched from the embassy, I won't say fired, which is a cruel word, he wasn't fired, but what happened was, you see, I mean, he wasn't a member of the Foreign Service, he wasn't a diplomat, he was a conservative politician, and in 1945 the Labour government got in, and we thought, well, that's it, I mean, we're going to be out on our ears as of next week. But fortunately, Ernie Bevin, who was a lovely ex-miner and the foreign secretary, who everybody loved, huge, hulking man, he looked like Stonehenge, but he absolutely loved my mother, and he was coming over almost every week for the Foreign Ministers' Conference, which was preparing the great peace conference for the following year. And my mother always gave him a wonderful time. And so he kept them on until the end of 1947.
Okay.
Which happened to be the exact moment I joined the Navy to do my national service. And after that, my father had a great friend in the shape of Sir Alexander Korda, who was the film producer, Hungarian, and the head of the British Film Producers Association. And he had this idea that my father should go out to the Venice Film Festival every year and represent the British film industry. My father had never taken a photograph in his life. He didn't know which end of a camera was which. But that didn't matter. I mean, the idea was to represent him and give dinner parties and, you know, be nice to people and make a bit of a show. So that's what happened for about 4 years running. And it fortunately happened at the beginning of September, which was my holidays. So I would go too. That's when I fell in love with Venice. And during that time, the Churchills were always, they used to go to the Lido for 2 weeks every summer.
Okay.
And Winston adored the cinema, absolutely loved it, and cried buckets at every film.
Oh, wow.
Always. There's a letter somewhere here where my mother says, towards the beginning of the war, they go and stay the weekend with the Churchills at this house they lived in the war, Ditchley in Oxfordshire. And she said, we had films in the evening, two dramas and a comedy. Winston cried at all of them, including the comedy.
Oh, that's amazing.
And yeah, he was a great crier, and we used to go to the movies together, my parents and the two Churchills and me. So occasionally I found myself actually sort of sitting next to him and heard the perpetual sobs. And he kept up a running commentary. I remember there was one terribly sad film we saw about Irish tinkers, Irish gypsies wandering around, and from time to time you heard poor people, poor people, and on one occasion I remember poor horse.
Poor horse, that's poor amazing horse.
And at the end he said to himself, not to me, to anybody, but just muttering to himself, jealousy, most barren of all vices.
Amazing.
I remember him hearing him say that.
Fantastic.
And so I was very lucky. I mean, my parents knew all these very distinguished people. And because I was around, I knew them too.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, that's a really nice thing about the letters, is that there's a real sense of your mother coming through as a personality and as a person.
Yes. Well, I mean, she did have a very strong character. And she was, as I think the letters show, she was the most terrific fun.
Mm.
She was marvellous fun to be with. She liked to make things hum.
Yes,
you know.
Yes. I mean, it's so warm.
She was a wonderful mum.
Mm.
Because, I mean, she adored me for the very good reason that she'd had to wait 10 years before I was born, and had been told that she could never have children. And then suddenly I popped out, everybody's great surprise. And so I was an only child and the last unexpected one. So she had, you know, she gave me an enormous amount of her time. It was she who taught me to read. I could read by the time I was four. Well, I could read when I was four, perhaps not by the time. I used to clamber into her bed every morning and we'd have reading lessons and arithmetic lessons and geography lessons and every sort of lesson. And she used to take me out on, she always had this cream convertible car, which was always open, except when it was absolutely pelting with rain. She always kept it open. And we used to go in the afternoon, she would take me out, and we used to do really exciting things like chasing fire engines, to see a really good fire at the end of it, things like that.
That's something I was going to ask you, actually. To what extent do these letters offer an insight into a world that doesn't exist anymore?
Oh, I think enormously. I mean, this is a completely, completely different that I grew up in. A world where you had perhaps a staff of six or seven servants. You know, I mean, that in itself was a thing. And my mum had a nightmare time with all that because, you know, there's nothing better than a good one, nothing worse than a bad one. You just undo all the damage they've done all the time. But it was, in those days, of course, you see, there were no labour-saving things. There were no washing up machines. There were no dishwashers. There were no, well, there were very primitive vacuum cleaners, but they weren't up to much. And you just, you know, just to get around, you needed, if you were living in a fair-sized house, it just didn't run itself.
No.
And also, I mean, there was, in those days, of course, there was a huge well of labour, and people needed jobs. And before the time we're talking about now, I think in 1910 or something like that, I remember reading that 90% of people in London were in some sort of domestic employment.
That's a huge change in 100 years, isn't it?
Can you imagine?
I know, it's crazy, yes. The book ends in 1952. Why did you decide to stop at that point?
Well, it was a watershed in my life, really, because I got married, I joined the Foreign Service, I started living in London. I mean, for a long time, there were no more letters much, because I would speak to my mother, if anything, I mean, she was living in France still, but we would talk on the telephone, you know, there weren't at that time anything like so many letters. When I went to Belgrade and subsequently Beirut in the Foreign Service, then the letters sort of started up again. But at that time, there were relatively few. Besides which, the book was already too long, and I thought, you know, we've got to stop somewhere.
It's incredible, yes.
This seemed a good moment to stop.
Yes, yes.
And, you know.
Had you looked at the letters much before?
No, I'd never looked at them between the day I first received them and between the day we started editing this.
That's amazing.
2 years ago.
Were there any letters that particularly stood out as favourites of yours, looking back at them?
Well, there's that one marvellous letter when they go and have lunch with the King and Queen, which is, I think, a lovely bit of sustained description and extremely funny and very typical of my mother, who's enormously observant about those sort of things.
Yeah. I mean, we haven't talked about your father, really, in all of this.
No. Well, I mean, he plays a bigger part in that book than one realises, because he's always there. Mm. In the background, you know. And I didn't see so much of him, not because he wasn't an admirable, conscientious father, he was, but because he was always terribly busy and working, you know, in the nature of things, I didn't see so much of him as my mother, who used to make an enormous amount of time for me. But she absolutely worshipped the ground he walked on. She didn't mind his endless love affairs, which there were really a great many. But she never minded. I said to her, you know, did you really not mind? And she said, no, darling, why should I mind? They made him happy, and I always knew they were the flowers, I was the tree.
That's so understanding.
It's so understanding, and it's also such a beautiful phrase.
It is, yes, yeah.
They were the flowers, I was the tree.
I know.
She was the tree, and she knew she was the tree. She was always the tree. And in my father's diaries, when he writes about these other ladies he's having things with, he actually says three or four times, but of course she's not a patron, Diana. Or if I had to choose between her and Diana, I'd be like choosing between the night and the day. It's something like that, you
know? Yeah, fantastic.
But she,
I mean, that's amazing. I mean, if you wanted readers to be left with a message from the book, or you wanted readers to take away anything from these letters?
I think really only that it is a picture of a completely vanished age, which we shall never see again. And it's also a picture of a perfectly fascinating woman who just sort of illuminated. I mean, she was occasionally given to considerable depression. That comes in the book too. She never made any secret of it. But most of the time, she really sort of illuminated the life around her because she was just such fun. Mm.
That was John Julius Norwich. Darling Monster, the letters of Lady Diana Cooper to her son, John Julius Norwich, 1939 to 1952, is out now, published by Chatto and Windus. And now we have a short advertisement break.
Tim Harris, author of Rebellion, describes the atmosphere in England leading up to the English Civil War from the perspective of both the kings and their subjects.
So this book is partly a royal biography. It's partly a biography of the two first Stuart kings, James I, Charles I, trying to understand their reigns from their own perspective, why they chose to tackle their problems that they recognised they faced in the way that they did, why they chose the particular strategies they did and why they chose certain paths to go down. So it's partly about what the kings were up to, but it's also about the people over whom they ruled, what it was like to live in early Stuart England, how people experienced royal government, how they were impacted by it, whether they welcomed the royal initiatives, whether they resented them. The book deals a lot with popular reactions to what was going on at this time period.
Rebellion is now available online and in all major bookshops, priced at £30.
Before our next interview, it's time for the latest history news with our website editor, Emma McFarnan.
Prime Minister David Cameron has launched a commission tasked with building a lasting memorial to the Holocaust. The commission, which has cross-party representation from Michael Gove, Ed Balls and Simon Hughes, will work to ensure that the mass killing of Jews is not forgotten. The Commission will hear evidence from people across the country on whether new measures should be taken to remember the Holocaust in Britain. It will present its findings to the Prime Minister by the end of the year. In other news, scientists have revealed what ancient Europeans looked like. Genetic tests carried out on two hunter-gatherer skeletons discovered in a cave in the mountains of northwest Spain in 2006 reveal that a hunter-gatherer who lived 7,000 years ago had the unusual combination of dark skin and hair and blue eyes. Scientists had previously thought that the early inhabitants of Europe were fair. The findings are published in the journal Nature. Meanwhile, almost 100 years on from the outbreak of the First World War, a tale has emerged of how a 67-year-old soldier became Britain's oldest known combatant victim. Henry Webber was far older than the maximum age to serve in the army, but had convinced the authorities to allow him to join up. He died on the Western Front. His story emerged following a series of supplements published by the Sunday Telegraph. Webber's great-grandson responded to an appeal for readers' stories.
Thanks for that, Emma. And don't forget to visit historyextra.com for all the latest history news. The idea of the individual is so deeply ingrained within Western thought that it's something that we rarely, if ever, consider. Yet in Larry Seedentop's new book, he argues that only by understanding how the concept has changed over time and its importance to the development of liberalism will people in the West be able to reverse what he sees as a crisis of confidence. Matt Elton caught up with him to find out more.
What first prompted you to write this book?
I think what seems to me to be a crisis of confidence in the West, a kind of demoralising, which is progressive and has many sources, I'm sure. Economic decline in relation to some other parts of the world, reduced, arguably, political power and influence. But also, I think, it's a crisis of belief. The West is no longer perhaps quite sure what it stands for. Mm. And it seems to me that there is a story which can be told and should be told in response to this, if the West is to take the part in the world which It should take, it seems to me.
Do you think that it's more important now than ever for people to know about the West's history, then?
Yes. Because what's happened is that the word and the idea, which seems to me to be central and distinctive in Western history, liberal, has had some bad innings of late. On the continent of Europe, it has become more dismissed more or less as market economics. French would call it Anglo-American economics, which is a kind of reduction of liberalism, as I understand it. And in the United States, more recently, liberal has ceased to be, has become a kind of pejorative, and it's associated with left-wingery, even perhaps with a touch of Marxism, and that seems to me to run against, you know, the central story of American social and political development.
What do we talk about, first of all, for listeners who perhaps are a bit unclear, when we talk about liberalism, what do we mean in this context?
Well, the central value, the central principle and goal of liberalism is, I think, encapsulated in the phrase equal liberty. And equal liberty, when applied to society and government, has very important implications. It implies that there's a sphere in which individuals, if at all possible, should be left to govern themselves. So the first thing to notice about liberalism, in contrast to a lot of the popular usage of the term these days, is that it isn't just a free-for-all. It isn't a matter of not believing anything. And a liberal society is one in which individuals are encouraged to and relied upon to, you know, to govern themselves according to certain principles.
I see. So it doesn't mean the absence of principles, it's a specific set of principles.
Yes.
Yes, fantastic. And of course we're here to talk about the history of those principles. How free were the societies in ancient Greece and Rome?
Some were free and others were not.
Yes.
Freedom was not, as you look, if you like, a moral principle in ancient Greece and Rome, though late Roman society, perhaps some qualification is needed. But to be free was to be a citizen and to enjoy a superior social status. And it was not something that applied to all equally.
No. I mean, that's fascinating in the book. I didn't realise the extent to which being rational was a status only bestowed on some parts of society, some members of society. How did that affect how the society was made up?
Well, it was certainly true of Greece and Rome, but I think if you look across the world and broadly, most societies have been organised in such a way that the family is the, as it were, the crucial social institution. And whether family, whether it's smaller or larger, a clan or a tribe or a caste. And I think what is distinctive about the West, as we know it, is that the fundamental social unit has ceased to be the family and become the individual. Of course, this has implications about what we mean by a family.
Yes, yes, that's true. So, I mean, did the notion of the individual exist in any sense as we know it now, in terms of the rights afforded to the role?
Well, I think if you're talking about the rights afforded, and it's no accident that liberalism is historically associated with a certain kind of legal system and the notion of basic or fundamental rights, I think the answer has to be outside this, has to be no.
Okay, no, that's great.
What we might call powers, which it were, and claims made, say, by citizens as members of that citizen, that privileged citizen group or class, would be better understood as privileges.
Mm, I see.
Rather than what we would call rights.
Mm, I understand. So we've got all these hierarchies set up. What factors cause that to be challenged or to be eroded?
Well, I think it's very striking the way the growth of empire in the last centuries BC, first the empire of Alexander and the successor states, and then the steady encroachment of Rome by the first century BC, involved a decline of the independence, the autonomy of the polis, of the city-state. And major social and institutional developments like that register in minds. And instead of looking to your own local citizen class as leaders, it became increasingly clear that power was moving elsewhere. Mm. You might make an analogy these days in Britain with the consequences of membership of the European Union.
Oh, okay.
Where we see, and it's not just Britain, all member states see their national parliaments in a sense losing power to the centre, ceding power to the centre, but at the same time retaining a kind of authority. But then you get a tension and a certain suspicion that things aren't what they seem to be because this supposedly autonomous city is no longer really autonomous. Religious beliefs also began to change.
Yes, I was going to say, actually, something you talk about in the book is the spread of Jewish beliefs at this point. What was it about them that became particularly appealing at this point in history?
Well, of course, there was a Jewish diaspora even in the around the Mediterranean, even before the destruction of Jerusalem in the first century AD. And Judaism introduced a kind of monotheism with this central, all-powerful deity, Yahweh. Mm. That, I think, had a certain increasing fascination for people who were living in a world in which Rome and its power, there was a certain parallel between that and Jewish beliefs, which perhaps created curiosity and opened the way to the spread of their beliefs. And what's fascinating is that by the first century BC, many of the synagogues around the Mediterranean had, as it were, non-Jewish adherents, and who were, I suppose you could say, flirting with monotheism.
Going back to the Christians, the early Christians, how did they go about setting up or building a new society based on their ideals? And how did that incorporate the idea of the individual, I suppose? Right.
Well, first of all, how did the movement spread? Well, it spread by persuasion. And that is, was for several centuries the most distinctive thing about it. And of course, in the face of, as it's grew and in importance and numbers as a movement, in the face of persecution. And so, the churches, there was a two-pronged strategy foisted on them on the one hand, they had to lie low because they were at risk. And so there was a tremendous sense of community as well. On the other hand, when there were periods of purging and when many Christians were martyred, there was something conspicuous about, it was interesting that the Romans often called them enemies of humanity because they stood out against the family gods and the civic gods.
That's quite a label, isn't
it? They were accused of impiety.
Yeah.
Impiety. They were, and there were all sorts of rumours circulated because they were driven into these communities which kept a low profile. There were all sorts of scurrilous rumours about their practices.
How did Christianity act as a force for social reform?
Well, it didn't immediately and openly push for social reform. But its habits gradually provided a platform for social reform. Now, what were some of the habits? Well, it's inclusiveness, first of all. Women were welcome, slaves were welcome, and, you know, they were given a home. Mm. And as the beginnings of a clerical order developed, with presbyters and bishops, and so the beginnings of what we would call the clergy, my own view is that the clergy contributed to what was the beginning of the end for the ancient family and pater familias, because it gave, as it were, it could serve as a kind of court of appeal for members of the family who would otherwise have been enclosed within the family.
I see. Okay, so there was an external agency they could appeal to.
Yes.
Yes, I understand. Okay, the whole notion of feudalism is interesting. I mean, how do you see feudalism as fitting into this story? Is it really the opposite of modernity, as some would claim?
Well, I think I'd like to mention one halfway house before we get to feudalism and the Middle Ages, and that is the Carolingian period, when I think you find very clearly two visions of social and of a rightly organized society and government, of social and political order coexisting. On the one hand, what is absolutely remarkable, and I think is clearly a sign of the gradual spreading and internalizing of Christian beliefs, Charlemagne and his clerical advisors, one of whom, of course, was Alcuin from the north of England, laid a great emphasis on oaths being sworn in order to establish a moral obligation, a moral bond between rulers and ruled.
I see.
And so you get this, something that would, I think, been inconceivable in the ancient world, where there were so many, where women and slaves were, as it were, permanently inferior. You get Charlemagne requiring oaths from his subjects, asking for oaths from his subjects, almost irrespective of status and gender.
Okay, so there was equality in that sense.
So there was, you know, in that sense, a kind of gesture, you could call it, if nothing more, towards moral equality. Mm. At the same time, he inherited a belief that there had to be, you know, for the government of such a society, a kind of more or less permanent political class.
Okay.
And so you get these things coexisting, and it's a fascinating...
That is interesting. It's so far in one direction, but then not quite.
Yes.
And it's interesting. So then, of course, we do move into feudalism eventually.
Yes. And here I think the response to... The response of the church and the higher clergy, there had been great emphasis in the Carolingian period on educating and improving the clergy. Their response to the collapse of the Carolingian Empire was that they became terrified of not only property, but power being dispersed everywhere, and perhaps the church itself being brought into what was becoming the feudal system, where local landowners also ruled their inhabitants. And the fear was that the church would lose its universal identity and its claim upon souls. And so, you know, the language of the, what you call it, the rhetoric of the care of souls, which had been important in this intervening period in the 7th, 8th, 9th century, led the clergy to fight hard for, you know, some continuing central organization.
I see.
And in due course, what central organization was available to them? Well, in the end, it was the papacy.
Right, yes.
And the papacy became the fulcrum on which a new legal system was gradually created from the later 11th century. And this is a system which did, in due course, you know, create the notion of basic or fundamental rights.
Mm. I mean, papal reform is a major player in your book. Why do you think its role has been, you know, overlooked for so long?
Well, I don't think it has been overlooked for so long, but I, insofar as people were impressed by the new strength and militancy of the church. But I think the significance of developments in canon law, that is, the legal system which the popes, starting in the second half of the 11th century and carrying on till certainly the end of the 13th, early 14th century, gradually created. This legal system, it led to lots of innovation. I mean, innovation which probably wasn't imagined at the outset. And but the unintended consequence of this remarkable development in within 100 or 200 years was that they took up an ancient idea of natural law, which had become important in the later period of Greek philosophy, and been speculative, an idea that of a kind of universality, which again was perhaps related to the spread of the Roman Empire. They took up the idea of natural law, but with Christian moral intuitions, turned it steadily into a theory of natural rights.
I see.
Of basic or fundamental rights for individuals, for souls.
I understand. So how did the emergence of papal law lead to the emergence of nation states?
I think, you know, kingship had, in well, especially in France, had really declined into not much more than a feudal naming game. And kings, even in Britain, even in England, and emperors in Germany, were more and more caught up in this very decentralized feudal system. And they were envious of the popes. I mean, they were jealous of this large-scale organization, increasingly well organized, in which papal orders and papal courts were, you know, sending down routes across Western Europe and drawing business and money and influence to Rome. I think they thought, why can't I do that? why can't I have something like that in my kingdom? And you know, it provided a model.
Okay.
And the attraction and you know, the growth of the idea of a sovereign authority, which is, you know, intrinsic to our idea of a state, of a nation state, turns on the equal subjection of, for want of a better word, individuals,
yeah,
to the sovereign agency. And that equal subjection was, I think, you know, borrowed from canon law.
I see. So what sort of period are we talking about that this happened?
Well, it was, you know, it was not momentary. I mean, it was a slow process and a very uneven process. But from the 12th to the 15th century.
I see. You talk in the book about Europe's undeclared civil war. What do you mean by this term?
Well, I think a number of things. As far as ideas are concerned, I mentioned already that liberalism seems to me to have been disfigured, the idea, by being on the continent associated with just market economics, and in the United States increasingly with unbelief, with indifference. And there is a philosophical tradition which I think has contributed to this, and it is fundamental to economics as a discipline, and that is utilitarianism, which has at times, you know, led to the suggestion that the state should be and that government should be neutral as between different beliefs. Well, I don't think neutrality is a notion associated with classical liberalism at all. Classical liberalism is a set of beliefs which are meant to protect an area of maximum autonomy for individuals, but also provide rules for intervening in individual behavior when they go beyond certain bounds. And in leading the West to see itself in these terms of non-belief, of kind of indifference, I think our ideas no longer correspond to our intuitions always.
Okay.
And I think that is dangerous.
So, I mean, going forward, what would be the way to help shore up Western stability in this sense? What could we do to help that in the future?
Well, the first thing, I think, is to help people to have confidence in their own tradition.
Okay.
And to, you know, understand, you know, the nature of that tradition. And, you know, a society where representative government, fundamental rights and judicial review, I mean, was created only very slowly and with great difficulty. And I think it's very important to understand how difficult they were to create and how fragile they are. I mean, you could say that we've rushed into things like invading Iraq, for instance, without anything like adequate appreciation of the cultures or Afghanistan, the cultures we're dealing with. Mm. And so I think having a clear sense of one's own culture can actually make it easier to understand differences in culture.
That was Larry Seedentop in conversation with Matt Elton. Larry's book, Inventing the Individual, The Origins of Western Liberalism, is out now, published by Annan Lane. And you can read more from his interview with Matt in the February issue of BBC History magazine, which has just gone on sale. Also in this issue, we're discussing whether or not Britain was right to fight the First World War, we're discovering the sinful secrets of medieval London, and we're explaining how a royal murder could have sparked a war in the Victorian era. Pick up your copy of our February issue now in all good newsagents and digitally. And just before we go, here's a reminder that BBC History magazine is holding two-day events in Bristol's M Shed on the weekend of the 15th and 16th of March. We begin with the Vikings Day on the Saturday and follow that with the First World War Day event on the Sunday. In each case, you'll get the chance to hear talks from a range of expert historians and enjoy a buffet lunch. For more information and tickets for both of these events, please visit historyextra.com/events. Well, that's almost all for this week. Do, as always, get in touch with your views on podcast@historyextra.com, and we might well read out some of your messages in the future. And you can keep in touch with us on social media. We are @HistoryExtra on Twitter, or find us on Facebook, facebook.com/HistoryExtra. And do make sure to visit our website, historyextra.com, where you'll find news, blogs, features, image galleries, quizzes, and more. In next week's episode, we'll be talking about Isambard Kingdom Brunel with his latest biographer, Eugene Byrne. and we'll be getting the backstory on a new BBC series, The Royal Cousins at War. Do join us for that. This History Extra podcast was recorded on location in Bath and Oxford and produced by Jack Fletcher. Thank you.